Good evening. Everyone looks familiar tonight. No new faces, but lots of returning faces. I'm wearing my father's watch tonight. He always wore a watch, despite his connection to his cell phone and computers like we all have, but he always wore a watch, and I figured that I needed a timepiece of my own for this sesshin, so that I wouldn't have to rely on my watch or my cell phone. So it's gonna be a new habit. You know, he wasn't much for bling, my father, but it's, got all these little stones around it. He always liked, the stories that your car has more electronics in it than the first flight to the moon. And so I think he liked the fact that watches could be pretty simple. And give you all you want, even without all the fancy electronics. So it just goes around. It doesn't do much. I don't even know whether this is a man's watch or a woman's watch, with all these stones on it. I just think he may have gotten a really cheap one that he was proud that it lasted forever, but, I'll have to take it to Antiques Roadshow and see what they think of it. But I'm wearing it tonight. I'm just thinking of sort of a segue into Robert's lecture last week about the Zen family style. And, I'm not going to talk about this tonight, but you just it's worth asking yourself, why you're sitting here, largely in black, cross-legged on black cushions. Why aren't you in one of those gold and red rooms at Land of Medicine Buddha? Or why aren't we all sitting in a circle on the floor at the Vipassana Center? I mean, what is it about this style that maybe it's unconscious now, but we stick around for a variety of reasons, and the style plays a part in it. I was with my larger biologic family Friday, a family funeral. One of my mother's brothers died. My mother was one of six kids. She was the oldest, and now there's just one aunt and one uncle left. And that family of six kids, Norwegian farm family from Montana, six kids, and there were 25 grandkids in that family, so I've got 25 cousins. I'm the oldest. My mother was the oldest, and the rest of the 25 all came in the next 10 years, so we're all about the same age. And they all stayed in Napa. Most of the family stayed in Napa. We moved down to San Luis Obispo, but we were up there a lot, making that 5-hour car ride. The family, my mother's family, got together quite a bit, holidays, and we all spent weeks and weeks every summer at Lake Berryessa, swimming and camping and barbecuing. So we always talk about those days. interesting, you know, of course, my cousins in Napa all saw each other growing up. You know, they went to high school together, and about half of them are still in Napa, and the other half sort of migrated to Sacramento. But so I don't know them so well in their adult lives. I don't really know all of their spouses' names, unfortunately. I'm not proud of that, but and I can't. I really don't know any of their kids' names. And they're having, my generation, of course, is having grandchildren now. So it was a big deal, Friday, the funeral. And most of us were there, most of the living relatives and most of the cousins were there. My uncle, who died, was married to his wife for 52 years, so it was a good long marriage, and he was married before that and had two other daughters that actually none of us have seen in probably 50 years. It's hard to think. I mean, I'm now talking, you know, my own family, it sounds like geologic time, even 50 years and whole lifetimes. But still, I know them pretty well. And, you know, those early years are our formative years. Even my aunts and uncles, you know, it was their young families and their first jobs. So I think in those brand new years and with us brand new people, really our real roots were really forming there. Our personality, you know, my cousins' personalities are the same. My youngest aunt and uncle, you know, they were teenagers when I was kind of growing up in elementary school. So you know, my aunt, who's in her mid-70s, I can still kind of see that teenage face in her. So it's those old connections, even though they're physically not so tight, when we get together like this, it turns out we know each other pretty well. And I think it's that kind of depth of a relationship. And of course, you know, now I'm going to talk about deep things. But I think it's we've got a family style. And it's really about those early, deep connections and our earliest ventures into the world. This family looked different than, my uncle worked in Napa for 50 years, and a lot of his work buddies were there, retired. You know, we could tell each other apart. They had a different style. I was amazed at how many people were at the funeral, and I teased my aunt. I said, I thought we were the only ones. You know, weren't there enough of us? That you had to have this whole other relationships with other people in your lives. But you could tell us apart because we had this style. Even my mother's Norwegian cousins were there. They grew up in Napa too. They were just like us, but rumor has it that they spoke Norwegian in their house, that my mother's aunt and uncle kept speaking Norwegian. But they were there, and they never. They like being with their cousins, my aunts and uncles. But just like me, they didn't pay much attention to their distant cousins, and I doubt if they know my name. But it was they're always at every event too. So we've got a real style, and. We're going to be practicing a Zen style over the next 5 days at the Sesshin. And you know, Kokyo has named this sesshin the ocean breeze sesshin. Now he says that he's named every sesshin, and but for some reason we've never talked about the other names. I'd love to go back and see if they're in the newsletter. You know, you've been announcing the ocean breeze sesshin for weeks now, and trust me, I've looked up all the Zen literature pertaining to ocean and breezes and wind. I've worked my way into sea. So we're going to be looking at this, trust me, we're going to be looking at this ocean mudra samadhi, a fascicle of Dogen's. You know, mudra is, you know, what we think of it as what we do with our hands. This, in our Soto family style, we use this, this is called the cosmic mudra. The left fingers over the right fingers and the thumbs barely touching. And we've got that nice stained glass window in the Dokusan room of a giant cosmic mudra. Supposedly it was done after a picture of Suzuki Roshi's hands in this cosmic mudra. And it's got, you know, stained glass, there's in the middle of the mudra is a sun and a moon, and jewels are the stars. So take a look at it the next time you're over there. So mudra is a hand position, but it's also it means posture. It's actually our whole posture, but we've sort of just looked at it, mudra meaning hand position. But it also means attitude, you know. And, you know, attitude, of course, is like a posture, or, you know, a ballet dancer is in a certain attitude, a certain pose. But it means our frame of mind, our attitude. So it has a lot of meaning. So ocean mudra, what is this? What is the meditation of the ocean? What is the attitude that this fascicle is going to describe to us that's based on the ocean meditation, the ocean samadhi? Catherine, this is Kaz Ta-Nehisi's translation, and this is one that Catherine did with Kaz Ta-Nehisi. And Kathy and I were talking about this. I don't remember, despite the fact that Catherine probably knew this one pretty well, I don't remember any classes that she taught. But Kathy has a vague memory that she may have done a...
It was maybe a lecture. Mm-hmm. I know it wasn't a class.
I'm getting a vague memory that at one of Kaz's visits down here, the two of them may have talked about it together in sort of a two-hour evening or a half day. Did you remember, Jean? Is any of... But I can remember them at least talking together in a panel about what it's like to translate, you know, from another language and how it's done. And, you know, Catherine was exacting. She was, you know, quite an editor. She was the editor of the Daily Cal newspaper when she was in college, and so she was quite an editor. What must she have been like to work with Kaz? And I'm sure she, just as much as Kaz, wanted to find the exact words. You know, she. Don't you think so? That's what I think. Buddhas and ancestors continuously maintain ocean mudra samadhi. While swimming in this samadhi, they expound, realize, and practice. Traveling through water includes journeying along the ocean bottom. This is called, quote, coursing along the bottom of the deepest ocean, end quote. The ocean differs from the sea of birth and death, where Buddhas vow to guide beings drifting in birth and death to the shore of liberation. Each Buddha ancestor breaks through the bamboo node. Kaz notes that this means intellectual thinking. Each Buddha ancestor breaks through the bamboo node and passes the barrier individually. This is done only through the power of the ocean mudra samadhi. The Buddhas vow to guide beings drifting through this ocean. So, swimming lessons from the Buddhas, or how to navigate this ocean of our lives, taught to us by these Buddhas. It's a great vision. Coursing along the bottom of the deepest ocean. It's quite a metaphor in many places of the Buddhist literature about the ocean is our lives. We've got the surface of the ocean that's disturbed by wind and storms, tsunamis. Sometimes it's very calm, glassy. That surface of the ocean is frequently our kind of small self, our personalities, our conventional lives, you know, where, you know, something happens at work and we're jolted, you know, by a wave. Something happens in our families and we've got another jolt, or something gets worked out we feel that calm of the ocean, or we get stuck. We get stuck sometimes, you know, with no wind at all. What are those called in the you know, when you're the doldrums? Yeah. So, you know, that's the surface of the ocean. It is that part of our lives. And then, you know, but then there's the bottom of the ocean, very deep, that no matter what's going on up at the top, it's just kind of calm and still and cool down at the bottom, undifferentiated. You know, there's not much, you know, it's not like there's a storm here, a storm there. It's just deep and cool and calm, undifferentiated, not much to take our attention away from ourselves. And it's, you know, there's no, you know, where does the surface end and the depth start? You know, it's this continuum. It's you know, it's the whole works. And our practice is to kind of remember the whole ocean. You know, we have mindfulness and we have our zazen where we really look at we look at our mind. That even I bet in these last 40 minutes, sometimes we were really jumping around at the surface, you know, with all of our thoughts and memories about the day or the week or the month or what's happening now. And then we kind of remember to follow our breath, to get into our bodies, to connect us with the rest of our bodies, with this firm platform that's grounded, you know, maybe at the bottom of the ocean. But at least when we come back to our breath, we get connected again to the whole ocean of our lives. We really we get connected once again, not only with what's going on in our lives that we have to deal with, but we also remember that, you know, no matter what we have to deal with, we're firmly in coursing along the bottom of the deepest ocean of our lives. And that's what our meditation helps us remember. It helps us to include the whole works. And that's what our mindfulness practice helps us do. You know, I'm always using the example of reaching for that coffee cup. And if I can reach with both hands, I'm just connected to it, not just, you know, not just thinking about the cup of coffee that's coming next, or I have to get, I have to gulp this down and get to work. But I'm connected with also the rest of my body that's coursing along the deepest ocean. So I remember the hugeness of my life, and our lives, and in that undifferentiated ocean, I can meet the rest of the universe. I can meet people at the surface of the ocean as well. You know, that's where, you know, maybe we'll be talking about the surface of the ocean when we're out there having tea tonight, or, you know, when I'm at work. But we can also meet people, or we feel our connections as well in that undifferentiated, cool, calm space that we all share at the deepest ocean. So, you know, what does it take in our lives to remember this connection, to remember the whole works, to remember the whole ocean of our lives? You know, what when we're sitting there in meditation, you know, try to remember what, you know, when you were lost in thought about stuff at work or stuff at home, what made you remember to come back to your breath and let that thought you know, drift off and remember your connection to the deepest ocean? What made you remember? Or you know, when you're at work or at home and feeling kind of tangled up, what makes you remember to sort of stop and take a deep breath and feel your connection to the whole ocean? You know, that's what we can do in our practice, is practice, you know, making that connection, expanding our repertoire of mindfulness bells. Is it a feeling? Is it an uncomfortable feeling that you get, that, you know, I need a remedy, I need an antidote to my seasickness? That makes you sort of say, oh, I'm connected to that deep ocean. you know, we're also supposed to practice in, you know, with when we're feeling pretty good, when we're really enjoying that dessert buffet at the family funeral. My uncle that died and my mother who died, but their connection was always this joke at Christmas time about who could stuff the fudge into the purse or into the, you know, so it was fitting to have this dessert buffet. But even in the midst of that, you're supposed to take a deep breath and say, you know, I'm loving this sailboat ride, and you know, it's nothing's moving in that deepest part of the ocean. I'm grounded in that deep part too. Maybe that's, you know, gratitude. I'm grateful for this connection with my family, for these great treats. And maybe the gratitude is, you know, the welling up of that cool, calm floor of the ocean. Maybe that's the connection. But you know, in all of our attitudes, no matter what our state of mind, a mindfulness bell should go off, and so that we can appreciate our connection to the whole ocean. The cousins don't smoke anymore. Nobody was smoking. All but one of them has given up drinking. The topic of conversation was still a lot about learning to water ski at Lake Berryessa. So we were all over the ocean of our lives and really connected to our deep roots at the bottom of the ocean. I have a few friends that like the family tradition of Tibetan Buddhism. Kokyo and Shoho right now, as a matter of fact, are at a Tibetan retreat in Colorado. And Kokyo talks a lot about his connection with a Tibetan teacher. Shoho is at a Buddhist university that has Tibetan roots, so people that we all know have good connections, but with Tibetan family style. But a friend was who practices at Land of Medicine was saying she was listening to a tape from a teacher who talked about meditation actually gives us some sails. I mean, I just want to use another metaphor. You know, we're all pretty. We all know that feeling of being battered around by the storms of our lives, the tsunamis of our lives, many times, or the doldrums of our lives, and this. This Tibetan teacher used the image that meditation and mindfulness give us sails to course through that life, or our lives. I liked that. It didn't bring in the sort of the kind of vertical depth, but the idea that mindfulness or meditation can be a remedy sometimes to that feeling of getting stuck in the storm or stuck in the doldrums. That's another image that is a sea wind image. So we're going to be looking at our ocean mudra samadhi in Sesshin. You've heard this before. Sesshin is like a contraction, a Japanese word that's a contraction, like wasn't or can't. Or it comes from setsu, shin, shin. Setsu means to gather, and shin is heart and mind. Sesshin, to gather the heart and mind. It's a pretty good image. We clean our food bowls in Sesshin with the setsu stick. It's nice to think of that as, you know, this stick that's used to gather all the last bits of food left on the bowl or in the bowls that are all bowls. For one last bit of nourishment. It's my family style that at 10 o'clock at night before every sesshin, I find myself hurriedly sewing on the new setsu tip. You know, the setsu stick has a cloth tip that you change between sesshins, and I change it. It's really fresh when I use it. But those first few stitches are accompanied with some cursing. It's 10 o'clock at night, and here I'm sewing this thing. So the setsu stick. I was recently asked by a senior student here about, what do you think? You know, do we really need to do sesshins? I like sesshins, but it sort of made me think, you know, like that earlier question, what is it about this particular family tradition, this family style? You know, why do I go? And I certainly, you know, I'm practicing with a lot of people who are serious practitioners of this family style who, you know, don't go to very many sesshins. You know, so I don't think it's a requirement. It's part of the family tradition, Soto Zen. So this practitioner was saying, well, why do you keep doing it? And I don't think I was very satisfied. I don't with the answer I gave. I don't really remember, but it was, you know, like a lot of Zen, you know, when you're asked to sort of say something, it starts with this you know, and you say something, and then it's something to think about later on. But I think just like we've had this 40 minutes of sitting, you know, where we've practiced, you know, coursing, you know, from the surface of our lives and our personalities, and you know, what are we up against, you know. And we're also connecting to that deep ocean floor, finding the stillness that helps us with all parts of our lives. I think we just get a lot more of that practice in Sesshin. We maybe get to hang out a little bit more at that ocean floor. I will confess to, doing most of my hanging out, you know, playing with the rudder, you know, trying to get control of that sailboat. I think Sesshin, so I think that's, you know, why, you know, I like coming to the Zen Center, why I like meditation, and I think Sesshin allows me to really hang out a little bit more? What's my style down there? What's my attitude? What is that ocean attitude? Really look at it. When does that mindfulness bell go off in my sitting, so that I come back to my breath and explore my connection with when I start coursing the depths of the deepest ocean? Is there sometimes resistance to going there, or am I caught, by on the surface? Is there something, why do I stay up there most of the time? It's not always that dessert buffet, let me tell you. But do I sometimes hold on to drama and to difficulty? And what's that about? So Sesshin really gives us a chance to take a look at what we're holding on to, what keeps us from that natural course flow between surface and our deepest ocean, our deepest self. What's my attitude? What's my ocean attitude? And I think everybody might say that's done a sesshin or two, or that maybe this is more the people that have taken on this practice, and this practice has been meaningful for them, and they keep signing up for these sesshins. I think everyone will say, it's kind of tough. Sometimes I really am there, and it feels like a tsunami in my head. I really am caught. I think everybody who does sesshins appreciates their bodies and some of the difficulties that come up in this physical body doing the long meditations. So I think everyone, even people who keep signing up for sesshins, will know those difficulties. But I think for me, and I think for other people, they're also nourished by this practice, by really looking at their ocean mudra, their attitude, by hanging out in the depths of their personal oceans. And I think at the end they'll say, this nourishes me. And it's that memory, that nourishment that we hold when we're signing up once again for the session. So it's the whole works. So that quiet that we have, that real break from our usual lives. We've told everybody that we're not coming into work. We've got other people that are answering the phone for us, and we've got other people holding down, feeding the cats. We're really taking this this break, and we know that it's going to be a bumpy ride, and since we've done it before, we also know that we're going to be nourished, that we're going to be well fed, that it's our nature to visit the depths of the ocean in our lives, and we're going to be nourished by that experience. So I think this ocean mudra is a good metaphor for why I keep signing up for Sesshin. We've got a couple minutes left. Maybe people can talk about their Sesshin, about what brings them to Sesshin, what this family style is about for them, or questions about this silent practice that we do. If people have questions about Sesshin, we've got a few minutes. Charlie.
It was about 10 years ago, and I made the comment that if you've been meditating a year or two and want to take the next step, Sesshin is a wonderful way to do it. So that's how I think of it.
Thank you. Charlie and several others have also taken on the practice of Tenzo, of being the cook during Sesshin, which I think has the same sort of fear if you've not done it before. You know, gee, it sounds like a lot of dishwashing. It sounds like a lot of chopping. And, you know, what's that got to do with my deepest self? And I think everybody who takes on the Tenzo practice sees what a practice that is for connecting to our deepest self as well. So every piece of Sesshin is really about that, is about coursing through the deepest ocean. Edie.
Well, what I noticed during the session is, well, this writing mind is when you take the light and take the light from the moon, I would listen to the light in my memory study rather than looking at the clock. Right now, we don't have a magic cup. Time and that's the study that a long time ago we didn't have a light sticker. And so I was listening to the light in the time. And then we let you do that.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other thing I think of right now is during the Sesshin coming out of the garden, for some reason the birds get closer when they're during the Sesshin than when that gives them all the time in the garden, because I can use it because I'm quiet enough for the birds to come a little bit closer. And so it's not this sort of thing, but it's sort of a different way to connect with a wider space.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. People are invited to share in that energy as well. I mean, there really is an energy that's created when we're sitting in here all day long, from 5 in the morning till 9 o'clock at night, and for people who aren't able to do the Sesshin, but would like to share in a little look at their sitting perhaps in a different way. You're invited to come, like in the evening, for instance. Anybody can drop in at 7:30 in the evening and sit the last two periods. So it's very quiet. You know, you can come after work or after dinner at home and then sit from sunset into the dark and kind of share that quiet space and have a different experience of this space in the way that Edie's describing, or come at 8:30 in the morning and sit and then sit another period and segue into the lecture after that. That's another natural way that people come in, or they can do an extra period in the morning, come at 5 in the morning and sit 2 periods and leave after the service. So those are all ways that you can drop in and have a little bit of a different experience of sitting, and kind of test the waters for Sesshin if you're flirting with it or you haven't done it before. Andrew.
Yeah, so those boys, 3-day sessions we have to go along with this similar metaphor of the ocean and water. I felt like the 40-day sauna period was almost like snorkeling or free diving, you know? But for me, I feel like I sort of need time to get to know that depth. And Sesshin, and especially I think being supported and nourished by the kitchen, that was awesome because it's sort of like you're feeding this oxygen down to the bottom of the ocean, you know, while down in our submarine, and it really kind of affords you the time and the space to really allow for sort of my interest in the moment to get a little bit more depth. I really appreciate
that. Yeah.
I wonder maybe
if you do a hair
that short, maybe it's like
rewarding
to wear a swim a little bit better.
Yeah, that's exactly it. That's exactly it.
I remember you did pretty good.
Although, you know, his hair is shorter than it was.
It is shorter than it was.
It's starting. when we first started going up to Jikoji for these sessions, Catherine would schedule in a few long walking meditation periods to be done outside, and the instruction was to, you know, sort of start at a regular walking pace. You know, and take a, you know, just sort of, you know, 30 feet fro and 30 feet to and 30 feet fro, just sort of go back and forth. And then, you know, start paying attention to your body, to your footsteps, you know, sort of layer on some mindfulness of this walking. And I found that, in the same way that Edie and Andrew were talking, you started picking up the pace of that, the rest of the universe that was around you, and you just naturally, you know, ended up being really slow, you know, because, you know, the rest of the universe was, you know, a little bit slower than our usual pace of life. So you start feeling that energy, and that rice, you know, Catherine would talk about the taste of plain that. That the Tenzo's master, you know, where you know, we just have that plain rice in the first bowl, and it's delicious and nourishing. I mean, you're tasting it, and you're hearing the rice. You know, it's everything. Our senses are a little more open, and so there's a lot of energy, or different kinds of energy that we feel in Sesshin. And I can assure you that there's more electronics in that rice cooker than there is in the flight to the moon. Chuck.
And then you just sign up, and I think that you hit on a really important point, that it's easier to fall back into the family style and drop some of the judgments and the fears. And a lot of it is fear. The pain, working with your mind, just the sheer discomfort in facing that is not an easy thing. And just do it again and again and again. So I kind of prefer to think that that's it. That, you know, I don't just forget every time that I'm terrified. But there's, like Andrew was kind of getting to, it's a way to get deeper. It's not a 40-minute sit. You're sitting from 5 in the morning till 9 at night, on and off and on and off and on and off. And after a couple of days, you really start settling to that quieter, calmer place and opening. So I think there's great benefit, great reward that is possible, and at the same time I think there's just this tremendous fear of that reality of this is very difficult to do, and let's just do it. Right? It baffles me to this day, because I think the last several sessions I've said that openly.
Well, it's. I mean, you find that, you know, this is a family tradition that takes care of you, that nurtures you even. And I think, you know, we complain of sometimes the pain in our knees or our backs or our shoulders, but some of the biggest distress is, you know, what's happening in our heads, and we find that this family style takes care of us and nurtures us, you know, just like, you know, that cousin that's finally off of probation is, we're all going to take care of him and each other. And so this is a demonstration of that, of this family style. Thank you.
Being loved.